No matter how my life was going in the locker room, when I got to step through that curtain, I'm the bad guy, and he's doing better than you.
And welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hitvice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover real revelations from some of pro wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host, J.P. Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator, Evan Husney. Dark Side of the Ring continues Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice TV with a look at the beer-swilling, cane-swinging ECW legend known as the Sandman, real name James Fullington. It is a crazy story, Evan, with one of the true renegades of 1990s wrestling.
I was a huge Sandman fan as a kid. I've talked about it with you guys before, this idea that when I grew up, I used to take the bus to the mall, and there was an RF video kiosk there in the mall where they sold all of the, you know, best of VHS compilations of ECW. And that got me obsessed with ECW. I also was able to get it at weird late hours of the night on my television set in my room, but it would always be fuzzy and you couldn't quite understand what was going on. But ECW changed my life in the late 90s. And I, for whatever reason, when I was a kid, I thought the coolest possible person you could aspire to be was the Sandman.
Oh, my God. Like, I'm glad you're still alive.
I know. Just this like amazing dirtbag, you know, smoking, chain smoking cigarettes, you know, pounding beers and, you know, Metallica and the whole thing. Thankfully, I got some other influences later down the line. But no, to me, he was like my style icon.
Did you want to walk down the street like hitting your head with a beer can until you bled?
Yeah.
Did you want to do that? Okay.
Yeah. Like I just, you know, he was my dirtbag style icon for sure. And so I always have a special place in my heart for Sandman. And I really, man, even going back in my later years, you know, more recently going back and watching, you know, some of those amazing 1997, 98 ECW shows, especially the one I always think about is the Stairway to Hell match with Sabu and Sandman. And just, from a filmmaking perspective, the handheld camera work, whoever the camera person was in ECW, capturing that like a war correspondent deserves a goddamn Pulitzer Prize, because it's some of my favorite, just grimy, the texture, the grit of that arena and that match in that moment is just some of my favorite ever filmed professional wrestling, you know, if you even want to call that professional wrestling.
Yeah, but, it's something a little different.
It's something different, but I have a lot of affection for it. And had a lot of affection for the Sandman. When we interviewed him in season two, which would be a great Unheard episode, by the way.
Just saying.
But when we did interview him for New Jack, he was so memorable, so fun. He had so much energy, stories for days, could talk for days. And it was like, we got to get this guy back. And so it was kind of like, can we do an episode about the Sandman? And it really, you know, when we got around to season five, and it was kind of not knowing the full story, but once again, and this happens a lot, you know, you might take for granted these stories if they could really work for your television program until you talk to the family, until you talk to the people that had to live with this fucking guy, you know, and just their perspective. And
in his case, they were in the ring. They were on ECW television doing angles, his son and his wife.
Just about to say, like, that's very unique, was the ideal, you know, the idea of his son who stepped into the ring with the Raven storyline and just hearing him being swept up into this, his wife being swept up. So, yeah, this is a good chronicle of his career and the highlights, but also the lows of his life and, you know, him dealing with a lot of issues and substance abuse issues and being a maniac, you know, inside and outside of the ring. But it was made with a lot of love because, like I said before, again, I was just such a huge fan. I mean, look at his intros. When he walks out to the ring, man, it's like a piece of performance art, you know? So I love it.
So Sandman coming up next on Dark Side of the Ring. And as much fun as the beer can smashing and guzzling was for ECW fans of the Sandman, it did,
as the episode will get into, signal a behind-the-scenes struggle with some excesses and proclivities and, you know, substance abuse challenges for James Fullington. It's also a story sort of illustrated by Scott Hall, the late former Razor Ramon and NWO renegade who saw his behind-the-scenes substance abuse struggles dramatized briefly in World Championship Wrestling for the TV audience. And unlike Sandman, though, it wasn't endearing, that portrayal, but really kind of like a dark marker of where Scott Hall was in his troubled life and before his untimely death. A little bit of a different episode here on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard. You know, the archives contain really lovely snapshots of top wrestlers' careers for those who, you know, sat for other interview subjects. You know, it's not a lot of the folks we're highlighting aren't sitting down to talk about their life and times. They're sitting down to talk about another wrestler. And in Scott Hall's case, he sat for you guys a couple of times, one for the Montreal episode and the Montreal Screwjob, and also for the Randy Savage Elizabeth episode. And the ties with him and Shawn Michaels, of course, came up in the context of the Montreal thing. And what you end up with is kind of a little sneaky snapshot of how Scott Hall got into the business, because all the main characters in the stories of both Montreal and Savage Elizabeth seem to have cross currents with Scott Hall's career. So you can kind of get a mosaic together. And JP, of course, Razor Ramon, everybody remembers his run in the mid to late 90s and being NWO Scott Hall as well. A guy that, you know, endlessly fascinating, very sad, untimely death for him. But a guy, you know, not unlike a Jake Roberts or others, who was pretty open about his substance abuse struggles. He even, you know, rehabbed with Diamond Dallas Page, just like Jake Roberts did. And just a guy that it's always fascinating to hear his one-of-a-kind sarcastic take on the wrestlers he ran into and the things he experienced.
It's so true. You know, I always think about, in terms of his openness, I think it was a WWE documentary. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was something else. I don't know. When he actually went back to the place where he killed that guy.
It was a 30 for 30.
Okay. And I just was like, to me, that was a whole different, like, it was a different ball game. It was very like Jake openness. And I really was not prepared for that. And I remember it being so affected and so, I felt more empathy for him than I ever thought I would. And, it was really incredible, but he's such a very, very fascinating, you know, kind of where he lies into the whole mold of wrestling and that whole, you know, early mid 90s to late 90s fabric, because he blossomed at a very, very interesting time.
Yeah. With an interesting philosophy on the business, like, don't give me this shit about kayfabe and I can't be with my boys on the road because I'm feuding with them on television. And, you know, that, of course, is the ethic and the ethos, I guess you could say, of the Clique, which, you know, was an infamous kind of stable of wrestlers that bonded together in 95 and WWF and basically ran the company, because they moved as a pack and they sought to influence what matches were made and who was given the star treatment as a pack. So we'll get into all that here in going through Scott's life and times as told to Dark Side Cameras. But Evan, quickly, you know, of course, Scott passed away. His whole story is there's been almost many Dark Sides done about him. The 30 for 30 is kind of that vibe a little bit. I'm sure you're sad to hear of his passing. What do you look back on? Because you only got him in season one, and it's kind of it's a story that has a lot of the beats that you look for. But at the same time, it wasn't a guy that you kept in his regular contact with as some other subject of Dark Side.
I mean, Scott was somebody that I would say that I got to know more than most of the people that are on our show. And I spent a lot of time with Scott before the show, actually, too. We mentioned last week for the Jake Roberts Unheard that we mentioned, you know, Jason and I's crazy watching the Royal Rumble at Sundance, which is a crazy experience, with Scott and Jake. And that was amazing and was so cool. But I did spend a lot of time talking and even met up with Scott a few times while we're kind of conceiving what Dark Side of the Ring was going to be, knowing that I wanted to do something in the doc space about wrestling. And Scott was someone that I gravitated towards because he got it. You know, he understood you know, the importance of sharing these stories and wanting to tell an authentic, true version of them. And so he just felt like somebody that would be a great subject. So there'd be times where he would be in town for a convention and we would make plans to meet up. And there was one time when I think Jason and I had like a little teaser trailer for our Bruiser Brody project, and I showed it to him and he'd be like, "Oh, that's cool, man. Brody was the shit, you know," and all that stuff. And then he would just be like, "Hey, you want to get some sushi?" You know? And so like, "Well, yes, I do. Of course I do." And so we went out, we had sushi, and he just told stories. And, you know, just like you were saying, his perspective was so unique. And that was when he unleashed to me that he thought the Montreal Screwjob was a work. And I'm like, "What the hell?"
Oh, boy.
And I was like, "All right, well, we got to get you in that episode then." And so we just started, like, you know, I just had a lot of respect for him. He was super funny. You could tell he's an incredibly intelligent guy. You know, he's a very smart guy, and was a great storyteller. And we kind of hit it off. And then I would see him periodically just at other shows, star casts I would see him at. And I'll never forget when we had our big, at the very first star cast, we had the Bruiser Brody premiere for our first episode was there. And he really wanted to see it super. He really wanted to see it. And he walked in with me and he saw all the people sitting there for the screening. And he's like, "Brody still draws, man."
That's awesome. I could totally picture him saying that.
You know, it's so funny. And yeah, I just have a lot of great memories. A lot of great memories with Scott. Unfortunately, after the sort of Plane Ride from Hell episode in season three, there were some things that were discussed in there that he was not particularly fond of. And we sort of ended on a pretty sour note, you know, from that. And I feel so bad for that because there was so much time that we spent, you know, before that. But, you know, is what it is, I guess.
You mentioned him saying Montreal was a work, and that's one of the real flashpoints of the episode you guys did. I've always wanted to ask you, you know, what was the fallout from that? I mean, putting that in there took some balls, you know, but I'd imagine not everybody thought that was a worthy inclusion in the narrative of what happened.
Well, it's mostly wrestling fans that feel that way, you know, about it, that have that take on it. You know, you have to remember at this time when we were putting together Dark Side of the Ring, you know, we already were fans, and, you know, our whole modus operandi was to recruit more wrestling fans or to get people to understand wrestling more, you know, who didn't already. So the concept that there's something, at least at the time, the thought process was there's something that's so monumentally controversial and there's so many, you know, intertwining cloak and dagger things going into the Montreal Screwjob, and it's this whole convoluted thing and it becomes this huge media frenzy. But you could have something in this. There is that perspective, you know, out there that some people do believe it's not a real thing. And now you have somebody, or believe it's a work, and now you have somebody even on the inside who's friends, very close friends with somebody who's involved in the Montreal Screwjob, who believes, and he wasn't working us, you know, unless that changes everything. If Scott's working us to then, you know, put it in the dock to further blur the lines, maybe he's smarter than all of us. I don't know, but I genuinely believe he does believe it's a work. And so to me, it just showed a whole nother dimension to this incident. And it was crazy. I remember at the time, right before the episode, the Montreal Screwjob episode dropped, we put a poll out on social media, like, you know, do you think it's a work or not? And it was like 40% of the people thought it was a work, you know, so people still believe that, you know, it's still a part of the story, you know.
This is the original business for that kind of thinking, man. I mean, these guys, they see designs everywhere they look, you know, because they live in a world where everyone's trying to manipulate outcomes to make as much money and to save face as much as possible.
Right. And that is something we were very keen on including. You know, we wanted to make the falsities and the fabrications, because there's, like, as we were saying last week, there's truthfulness in that. You know, that is true to a lot of the people in this business. And that's something we wanted to include in the greater picture of what we were documenting.
We mentioned his ties with Shawn Michaels, who, of course, was 1A to 1B to the Bret Hart situation in Montreal. And the ties between Shawn Michaels and Scott Hall run very deep. They extend way further back than when they shared the ring together for classic matches in the WWF, such as, of course, the ladder match at WrestleMania 10 that everybody remembers, and then the subsequent learning that they were basically a clique running the show backstage. In sitting with you guys for the Montreal Screwjob episode, Scott Hall tells a story of breaking into the wrestling business in a smaller territory, the Central States, Kansas City area, where they both got one of their first big breaks. Both Scott Hall and Shawn Michaels were completely wet behind the ears newcomers to the business, and how Scott Hall benefited from the friendship of Shawn Michaels even back then.
I met Shawn in the Kansas City territory, and he had come up from San Antonio, and even when he was young, he was great. I mean, when he left the Dallas territory, he was doing jobs on TV for guys and calling the match to the guys. Calling the match to the guys who were beating him. He was talented from the very beginning. And when he first came in, you know, I'm kind of like a big badass. So here's a young pretty boy. Ooh, perfect. Let me get my hands on him. And then when you see him perform, you go, oh my gosh, there's no limit to what he can do athletically. And he's not selfish. Like, he'll have an idea for you. He'll go, Scott, do this to me. You know, I've seen you do that. Do this to me. Like, I never backdrop anybody because I never give a guy a bump that I won't take. But Shawn will call backdrop because we had such good timing. I could launch him. When we were in Kansas City, I would launch him and he would kick the ring lights. And the ring crew guy would get pissed off. And every night he'd pull it up a couple feet higher. And that just challenged us for me to hit him higher. I remember our first road trip together in that Kansas City territory. He kind of laid out to me the nuts and bolts of a match. And no one had ever done that before. I remember going, like, it was like life-changing. I went, oh, like a light bulb went on. I'm like, oh, that's it.
So he has a lot to owe Shawn Michaels in that regard. And JP, it's so great to see Scott, you know, over the years doing shoot interviews and stuff, having this ironic distance from everything, right? But there, he just dives passionately into the mechanics of putting a match together. This is a guy, for as little as he wanted you to think, he took the business very, very seriously. This guy really talks in a way where it's like he loves this stuff.
I remember listening to him on Austin's podcast years ago. And I remember just being blown away by kind of the creative and intelligent mind he had for wrestling. Because, right, you really don't think he would have that because he acts like he doesn't care whenever he's on camera. Like, he's actually, hey, yo, fuck it, you know? But he really has such a keen and very clever intellect about it all. And I'm always surprised when he kind of gets down and dirty into describing stuff like matches and coming up with, you know, scenarios and whatnot.
And he's got a very keen perspective on just like bird's eye view of the business, I feel like, too. You know, he never loses sight about what it's all about. He's very oil and water to someone like Bret Hart. You know, and that was another kind of reason to include him, at least from what we were thinking about for the Montreal Screwjob episode, because, you know, Bret Hart classically is someone who, you know, does take his accolades very seriously, as he should. And, you know, he likes to talk about those and, you know, Scott always reminds you it's a fucking work, you know. And so they come from two different sort of philosophies, but both extremely passionate about the business.
Yeah, nothing I have to do there, Evan. You queued it up masterfully. Our next piece of sound, you know, as they get over in the WWF, Shawn and Razor together, they didn't drop the aforementioned camaraderie formed there breaking in the Kansas City territory. In contradiction to the kayfabe we spend so much time harping on as wrestling fans, that's all starting to slip in the business. And to Scott's mind, it's all for the better. And it kind of sets up the collision course of philosophies that's laid bare by the whole Shawn Michaels-Bret Hart dynamic in Montreal. Which, of course, he has an interesting perspective on. So here a bit of a contrast with how he viewed the Bret side of the coin.
I'll never forget one time we were in Germany somewhere, and a reporter came up to me and said, well, tonight you will fight Shawn Michaels. I said, yeah. And he goes, but afterwards you will have a beer together. I said, yeah, but I can drink one faster than him. You know, like, I don't hate him. I'm just better than him. Like, I never liked the whole I hate you angle. To me, that doesn't sell tickets. I'll never forget one time Sting did an interview and said, Scott Hall, I'm going to kill you. So when he came back from the ring, I was waiting at the curtain. I said, yo, Sting, I have to call home now because my children think Sting's going to kill their daddy. I said, why would you say something like that? Because you're not going to kill me. Yeah, I never, that doesn't draw money. The way I was taught is The belts have to mean something, and personal angles draw money. But it's about pinning the guy or making him tap out, making him submit. It's not about, I hate you, I'm going to kill you. Killings don't draw money. People don't line up for hangings. People want to see a prize fight, a contest, in my opinion.
I think people do line up for hangings, but that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, different podcast.
Hate to quibble with your point there, Scott, but yeah, I mean, a guy who, you know, is drawing that delineation so that he can, you know, do what he wants on the road in terms of fraternizing with guys and not having to, you know, be shook by a reporter who says, hey, I caught you with your enemy in public there. Look like you guys, it's like, okay. Like, Scott's all about disarming that kind of thing, you know, very much so. And here, as talked about, this is kind of complementary with Bret Hart's philosophy on things. But when it comes to, like, really drawing a line between how you treat the business when you're on camera versus how you treat the business in public, that's a big contrast between Bret Hart and Scott Hall.
What do you think about Bret as a performer?
I think he's almost as good as he thinks he is. I don't agree with everything he does because we used to call him the 400 grand a year champ. He doesn't really care about the money, he just wants to win. Where you look at guys like the Ultimate Warrior, they don't care about winning or losing, they just want the cheddar. I tried to mold myself after Warrior. You know, I don't care about winning or losing because it's fake either way. Send me the money.
Explain why, or like, why do you think he cares so much about winning?
I have no idea. I grew up knowing it was fake because when I was gigantic and jacked up on steroids, I was doing jobs. I was losing every night. And in that era, when I broke in the mid-80s, it was kind of a rule. You learn how to lose before you learn how to win. That way, just to make sure you understand how things work, we're going to beat you like a drum for a while. Before you ever get your hand raised, you're going to lay on your back for a while. So you understand that it's a work, that it's a show. Because some guys believe it's real. Like, to them, it's real. I never suffered from that.
We hear that kind of traffic in the background. Are you sitting in Scott's living room here, Evan? What's the setting?
Yeah, it's bringing me back to the I'm being re-triggered by the audio at the location. This was in New Orleans. This was for that WrestleMania that was there. Well, I can't remember. This would have been 2018, I think. I don't know what number WrestleMania it was, but we were there in WrestleMania in New Orleans, and we shot a bunch of interviews there. It was kind of perfect timing because we could do Scott, we did Eric, we did a couple other people there at that time. But yeah, I love the contrarian, if you will, viewpoint of wrestling. I'm going to model myself after the Ultimate Warrior. Who has ever said that? Nobody.
And who's ever said that the Ultimate Warrior doesn't have a problem losing?
Oh, just give me the check. Sure. But I remember now from that interview, he was putting the Ultimate Warrior over more than once in this interview, where he's sort of saying, you know, he was about the money. Hell, he got his own dressing room with his name on it. Of course, that's what I want. That's what you should strive to get, you know, da 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 da. And I do now remember trying to get him, Scott, one of the last moments I remember, or one of the last times I remember contacting Scott was, we got to get you in the Ultimate Warrior episode because we need somebody to say something positive, you know?
Oh, right.
You know?
Right.
And I just remembered, like, hey, he was the guy that had this viewpoint, but it didn't work out.
Yeah, he came in, JP, of course, at a time when Ultimate Warrior had returned to the WWF at WrestleMania 8 in 1992. And by the end of the year, kind of the vacuum that was created by Warrior suddenly being fired due to getting shipments of certain substances put Scott Hall in a position to really, Razor Ramon, to really step right into the forefront. Day one, he's one of the top guys in WWF.
That's really my bread and butter period. And I remember how hard they were pushing him and kind of just how he skyrocketed up to main event status, you know, by Survivor Series, really, and then the Royal Rumble. It was crazy. What I think was impressive about it was that I bought it. I bought the character. I bought the character as being a major threat to all of my heroes. I genuinely thought there was a possibility that he was going to beat Bret Hart at the Royal Rumble in 93.
Yeah, he was plugged right in there as one of Bret's first pay-per-view opponents after Shawn Michaels, interestingly enough. So the WWF starting to change. Guys, you know, of Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart's stature are starting to get the main event position after all the steroid scandals and the bodies start shrinking. And here comes Scott Hall, who, you know, was a big guy. He was much bigger than the AWA. He just told us right there he was juicing. I mean, he didn't hold back. But, you know, so by the time comes WWF, he's smaller, but all of a sudden he's one of the bigger guys on roster, and he's got that physical credibility over, you know, a Randy Savage, who had shrunk considerably by the time they crossed paths in November 92. So this is Scott Hall absorbing kind of like the lay of the land as such as it was in late 92. He's seeing Warrior as the guy operating at the highest level as opposed to a Hogan in terms of, you know, negotiating and having an attitude about the business that he sought to learn from, because that's the guy making the most money. That's the guy, you know, that I obviously want to emulate. So this whole sort of disinterest in taking wrestling too seriously, or as seriously as his forefathers probably would have liked him to, is kind of taken to an extreme with the aforementioned Click faction. There was a moment in Madison Square Garden in 1996, people at all familiar with the story know where I'm going with this, where despite the fact that Scott Hall, Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Triple H, who, you know, today is a key executive over there, they all sort of were in a position of battling each other on television, but sort of having no qualms, and Sean, I should mention Sean Waltman, 1-2-3 Kid as well, having no qualms about fraternizing on the road. And in fact, when it was time for Kevin Nash and Scott Hall to make their jump to WCW in 1996, which led to the transformative NWO angle, they decided to have a moment before the people in the, you know, the key arena for the territory, most important wrestling arena in the world, Madison Square Garden, where they come out, and despite hating each other, Shawn Michaels and Diesel just try to kill each other in a cage. Razor Ramon had just fought Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Triple H, earlier on the show. They all come out and embrace and hug, and a big nod to the audience that everybody, you know, on the inside knows that Scott's going to WCW. It was well known at the time, and they just want to have a moment as friends, and that really rubbed traditionalists the wrong way in so many ways, that they would go out there and just say, okay, now all the phony baloney bullshit's over. It's time for a real moment among friends. And Scott Hall talks to you guys about that when he's talking about how he came up in the business and how he got to know Shawn Michaels. And of course, this is a formative experience. He starts telling you guys about how Vince McMahon, right after this incident, backstage at Madison Square Garden, calls Scott aside and says, I want to see you back here.
So I go, wow, Vince is finally, he wants to see me, huh? So I walk in, he goes, damn it, you still work for me. He goes, how much them sons of bitches offer you? I said, Vince, it's a little bit late to be talking about that. I came to you 3 months ago. And he went, damn it, how much? I said, I told Eric Bischoff I'm coming to work for him tomorrow. I don't feel comfortable. He went, how much? So I told him, he went, ooh. He went, that's a pretty good money. I said, I know. I ain't asking you to match it. I asked you months ago to match it. And you told me no. And then Shawn came in. Shawn Michaels burst in. And he goes, boss, I want Shawn, I want Razor to come out after the match. Which, like, he wrestled Kev Diesel that night. And they were setting up the cage. As I'm having this meeting with Vince, it's intermission, they're setting the cage up. They're having a cage match. And he goes, I want Razor to come out, you know, after the match. And Vince goes, is it important to you? He goes, yeah. He goes, okay, make it happen. So we did. And now I have had a long history with Shawn in the Garden. You know, we had matches there before. We had the WrestleMania 10 match there. So I go down the aisle, and I'm looking at Shawn thinking, people never know what might happen. I'm like, oh, he's staying. He is staying. I get in a ring with, and I'm going to try to milk the crowd a little bit with Shawn. Shawn just runs up to me and hugs me. So there goes that, you know. And it was really emotional because, you know, we've been buds forever, and now we're leaving. We're going to WCW. We don't know what's going to happen there. We know we're getting paid.
This guy and his, like, transactional nature is just, it's such a change, such a sea change.
In this business, you can either make friends or you can make some money. You know, he's got the friends. He'd like to make the money.
That's one of his famous quips. So, Evan, you're a 90s wrestling fanatic. I think I've even seen pictures of you with an NWO mm-hmm. shirt on, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So what of that moment where Scott Hall, Razor Ramon, as we knew him at the time, disappears from WWF and shows up at WCW?
Oh, my God. I mean, that was everything for me. I mean, the NWO was so big for me as a kid. I definitely was much more of a WCW kid than I was a WWF guy until probably, like everybody else, you know, when that sea change started to happen with, you know, Mankind winning the belt and that setting that, you know, the ratings went that direction. But man, NWO was huge for me. And I would go to Nitros all the time growing up in Minneapolis. Nitro would come through almost every few months. So I went to all the shows. And I just, yeah, obviously looked up to Scott so much and Kevin Nash and the whole thing. It was awesome. It was a great time to be a wrestling fan. And he just meant so much to me as a kid. And it was just, I just remember in these season one interviews, it was just, it was a wild, surreal experience to be on the other side of this person that you, had grown up idolizing and, you know, playing as in video games and owned action figures of and, you know, things like that. And then getting to know the real person. And then I remember right after this interview, we had dinner together. We had this guy, it was such a crazy thing. We were staying at this crazy house in New Orleans and my friend who booked the place, it was a huge Airbnb. Like he booked a chef to come to like cook for us after this interview. And Scott was hanging around and he just kind of had like some match flashback. And he was like reenacting an entire match that he had like 25 years ago and like in the backyard. And I was like, Jesus Christ, be careful, man. You don't fucking fall and trip. And his leg.
Is he taking bumps? Like what's he doing?
He wasn't taking bumps, but he was like pantomiming almost every action of what was going on. And he had like some crazy thing going on with his leg that he was like screaming about the whole time. And I was just like worried that he was going to topple over or he was going to. You know, he was perfectly sober. It was just the enthusiasm was on a high level, let's say. It was cool.
So a lot of interesting little factoids there in him talking about these critical moments in the Monday Night Wars in the 1990s, wrestling boom and explosion that he played such a key role in. And there's that little nugget there that Vince McMahon made that last ditch attempt to match whatever WCW was offering him, knowing this was Scott's last night in WWF. That last ditch attempt to feel him out on whether he could keep him was just so fascinating. And obviously the deal is not made. He goes to WCW. Eric Bischoff himself picks him up at the airport, the WCW boss at the time, and drives him to Nitro. And everybody remembers this Nitro. We're right in the middle of a match and Scott Hall in a denim vest and jeans on. He just walks through the crowd and gets into the ring and takes the microphone and talks about how you want a war where you're going to get one, kind of signaling to the audience that he's here flying the WWF flag and what the hell is going on. This is a hostile takeover. Of course, the NWO, probably the most successful angle in the history of the business, one of the top two or three for sure, when you think about how it totally reversed WCW's fortunes and switched the momentum in the Monday Night War. So the impact is there, and Scott Hall talked to you guys about that. And interestingly, in terms of like little nuggets about moments that we always hear about over and over again, he did have an interesting little aside when he talked about the architecture of that famous promo on May 1996 on WCW Monday Nitro, and who actually deserves credit for the most important touch, perhaps, to that famous interview.
In the production meeting, Eric Bischoff gives me one line. You people know who I am, but you don't know why I'm here. He says, I want you to say that. I said, okay, whatever you want, boss. And he's talking about it. Now, Eric would have sent me down the aisle with ring music and all that, like, hey, here he is. Larry Zbysko, who I knew from the AWA in the 80s, and who's a genius, and he really helped me then when he didn't have to, is in a meeting. He's an announcer now. And he goes, no, you can't do that. He doesn't work for us. He has to come through the crowd, interrupt a match. And he's going, not interrupt the match by beating the guys up. Just go straight to the microphone like it's real, like he's here to talk, because all the wrestlers know everybody. They're just going to go, Scott, what are you doing? We're out here having a match, man. You're effing it up. What are you doing? And that was Larry's idea, and we did it, and it worked.
How about it, JP? Larry Zbysko gets the credit for that key touch of Scott coming through the crowd.
Part of me is not surprised at all, especially, you know, that he would be very involved with the New World Order.
And they went on to battle and feud. Hall versus Zbysko was a hot little program there for a while.
It was.
What do you remember about this interview? And how much different would it have been if he came down the aisle to music?
It would have been disastrous if he fucking came down to music. Unlike Evan, I was a very hardcore pro-WWE fan. To me, they were the good guys. WCW was the bad guy. And when I saw Hall come down, I was like, oh, I didn't think like WWE was invading. I said, oh shit, we lost Hall. It's kind of funny. I never bought it as, are they really coming or whatever? You know, I never really saw it as that. I mean, as being real, I was just like, ah, oh, shit. Like, there goes another one. And I just, that was my initial feeling. Obviously later on, I grew to really appreciate it as a storytelling technique, and it was incredible. And I guess I can thank Larry Zbyszko for that. So thanks, Larry.
And little did you know, at the time, Kevin Nash was soon to follow. Of course,
a bigger star. I was so depressed when all that happened. Just miserable. Because I'm like, these are two guys that I've invested in since 1992. 92, 93. And I'm like, are you kidding me? They're just
Diesel was like your Hulk Hogan replacement almost.
I fully admit in, you know, post 1993, I drank the Kool-Aid. Whoever they told me was going to be Hulk Hogan was Hulk Hogan, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Amazing.
You know, and so to keep losing these guys, and I'm like, oh, come on.
Because my experience was different only in that that time period, I wasn't watching wrestling. So I, as a small child, I was into, you know, that, I want to say 1990, 89, 90, like WWF. Like I clearly remember the Hogan Slaughter conflict, you know, the Iraqi sympathizer angle, and also Warrior Hogan. I do remember as well. That was like where I was focused. I put wrestling away for a while, and I missed this. I missed the 96.
So you were a lapsed fan.
Lapsed fan, baby. Yes. And I didn't come back until probably late 97. When I think maybe late 97, because it was the N64 games got me back into wrestling. And then the first real pay-per-view that I remember convincing my parents to buy was, was it 98 Sold Out? Was that with Nash and the Giant?
And Bret versus Flair.
Yeah,
and
so I missed all the great shit, you know.
Not only was Kevin Nash soon to follow, but Hulk Hogan, who you mentioned there, JP, is Diesel being a replacement for, is going to turn heel. And, you know, he got a view, Scott Hall, he got a bird's eye view on a guy that he didn't really see operate in the WWF much. Their paths barely crossed, Scott Hall's and Hulk Hogan's, before WCW. And, you know, in the interview, he gives great glimpses of the NWO kind of behind the scenes after the show was over. And, he talks about a whole lot of different experiences he had as the NWO begins to take off and explode. He talks about how different Hulk Hogan was with and without his wife around, which is interesting. And how, you know, if you get a phone call in the room, if he called Hogan in the room and Linda was there with Hulk, it was one tone of voice. And if Linda wasn't there, it was another. Just, I love this sort of behind the scenes as the NWO is becoming a thing. And they're talking and they're interacting and they're getting to know each other. So this is Scott Hall explaining kind of what it was like.
Hulk is so famous and so popular that after a show, he can't even go to the hotel bar. Like most of the boys would go to the hotel bar and have a few to unwind, or a few too many. Hulk can't even go to the hotel bar because he will be hounded by the staff, by the fans, by everybody, other wrestlers, by everybody. So Hulk would stay in his suite, and he'd go, hey, brother, come on up. I got a couple cases of beer, and I'm going to order some chicken breasts. You know, we'll sit around and talk about how cool we are. And so a lot of times I knew Hulk would be in his room alone, so after TV, I would call his room. Because, you know, Hulk stayed up late. We all stayed up late, because when you leave the ring at midnight, you're wide awake. So it's like 1 o'clock, and I call Hulk, like, hey, what are you doing, brother? I call the room, and it's like, hello. It's his wife. Well, his then-wife, Linda. And I remember going, oh, Miss Hogan, I'm so sorry. Well, Miss Bollea, I'm so sorry. I was just wanting to talk to Terry. I'm sorry. I didn't know you were in town. I apologize. Oh, that's okay. I'll tell him you called. I just knew that when some guys, you get to know them, but then when their wives are around, they're totally different. Like, Hulk seemed less happy to me when his ex was present.
Always a keen judge of character, Evan. Scott Hall.
Yeah, and we interviewed Hulk's ex for this episode.
Now, did he mention her independent of knowing that? Or do you recall? Had you already spoke?
I think that was a coincidence. Again, it was a weird move, but I'm glad we did it, interviewing Linda Hogan, because it was very difficult. I remember at the time trying to find anybody to speak on Miss Elizabeth's behalf that wasn't sort of, for lack of a better term, like tainted on the, you know, from the Randy perspective, if you will. So somebody that could relate to being the partner of the wrestler and having to deal with that, and then also traveling on the road. I think her involvement in the episode, I think, raised a lot of eyebrows. Like, I think people got a lot of, people were afraid of what she was going to say. I think she was afraid of what she was going to say on the show. But it was really just, you know, for the reasons of trying to get something similar to what Miss Elizabeth's experience was like in those days. And the other complication being that Miss Elizabeth's family was absolutely not down to participate at all whatsoever. And so then it was, we were kind of like left with nothing. And so, I remember one day in the office, like, well, what if Linda Hogan? So, yeah.
And what a blessing it was, because she had all those wonderful photos from when they used to go out and socialize together. When
some of my favorite photos we've ever used for the show came from her. That insane photo of Vince on the boat.
With the Speedo on. A lot going on there.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Liz, and it's clear that, you know, she fell victim to the drug culture of WCW. WCW had a drug problem. I think it's pretty apparent. Scott Hall speaks to it. And he, you know, he himself certainly knew, because he had a bad drug problem as well. And I thought one of the most interesting things he talked to you guys about was kind of, I don't know, I guess you could say taking ownership or feeling some complicity in Liz getting down that road, because she was with Lex Luger, and that was kind of a toxic coupling in terms of, you know, codependencies and drugs and things. And that's kind of what led to her demise in a lot of ways, is she came into Lex's life at a time when they were both leaning into experimenting with painkillers, and it got out of control really quickly. But as Scott Hall shared with you guys in sitting down to talk about Elizabeth, he felt a little bad about those two going down that particular road because of what he was going through and changes he was ushering into the NWO's sort of on-the-road culture.
Regarding Lex's drug use, you know, at his second run in WCW, I feel a certain amount of responsibility, because Kevin Nash and I traveled together forever. And I was going through a divorce, and I wasn't handling it very well, and I didn't like me, so I really didn't care what anybody else thought about me. And I was drinking and taking pills to excess. And it got to the point where Kev, and he's like my big brother, went, I can't travel with you anymore, man. I love you, but I can't travel with you. I don't care. I'm going to ride with Steve McMichael. Because he had some mules from Mexico bringing Yayo to every TV.
Oh.
So that's okay, Kev. I'll ride with Mongo. And Lex started riding with Kev. At this time, Lex transitioned from skin-tight jeans and tight shirts to baggy jeans and FUBU shirts, because that's how Kev dresses. Kev's a big cool cat from Detroit. Also, a thing about Kev is, like, when you roll with certain guys, like their pills and like their booze. And Lex is a guy who never did drugs or never really drank to excess. Until now he's in his 40s and he starts rolling that way. And I felt really responsible for that, because he took my spot in the car. Because at that time we had a lot of luchadors, a lot of Mexican wrestlers coming in and out. And drugs are plentiful in Mexico. And you give those guys money and they'd bring them across the border for
you.
So drugs are plenty and booze are plenty and recipe for disaster.
I remember, JP, when suddenly Lex started wearing the FUBU clothes, and he was in the Wolf Pack and everything, and he just took Scott Hall's place in the car.
I forgot about that.
I wasn't really watching, but I do remember when Lex was kind of in the Wolf Pack, and it felt weird, and now I know why it felt weird.
That's like when I came in to watch wrestling. That's what I got. I come back to wrestling as this lapsed fan, and I get Lex Luger and the fucking Wolfpack.
Yeah, that FUBU. Was fascinating. And it turned out to be like a legitimate shift in his mentality and approach, because he was like the cleanest guy, you know, like bodybuilder, watched every ounce of food he put in his mouth and tried to stay as clean as possible. That was his whole, you know, kit and caboodle there. And yeah, Evan, there's Scott kind of... you know, having to disassociate himself with the crew he ran with to get into this incredibly lucrative run, because he just needed the drugs. And there goes Lex. Something else.
Wow. Yeah. It's also like very sad and like midlife crisis, you know, is what that says kind of to me too. Oof.
Lex Luger in ripaway basketball pants. I mean,
Oh,
it's a tough look.
Well, it's better than that. Like the those weird that jumpsuit that he wore in 1994. So I'll take.
Okay. All right. So you do have that one core memory, huh?
All right. Well, so was Lex then somebody that you were drinking the Kool-Aid of as the next Hogan as well too?
Absolutely. He was totally Hogan. No question.
He was totally Hogan.
He slammed the big totally fat Hogan. Guy. Yeah. Right?
You know, like the moment he came off the thing, it's like, you know, I had this moment of like, you know, why is Luger coming out of the helicopter? And then he slammed him and basically my mind went, Hulk Hogan!
Well, I think that's exactly what they wanted. So
target demo.
Oh, totally. Totally.
But as we know, it went precipitously south for Scott Hall from the moment he just referenced where he started leaning too much into illicit substances at WCW. I mentioned at the top that they even did an angle once on Nitro where he vomited all over the place because he was on an anti-alcohol medication that caused him to get nauseous at the simple slight, the sight and the smell of alcohol, which was a shoot. He was really on those pills backstage and they put it on television. It was one of the ugliest scenes. They used cream of mushroom soup to replicate the vomit there. So it was kind of an ignominious time. It was not, you know, a time where a very flattering time for Scott Hall, and it just got worse. And he had several stints in rehab. We know the documentaries that have charted his struggles over the years. And so we went through a lot of wild stuff. Scandal, you mentioned, JP, that revelation that he killed somebody back when he was, you know, bar hopping and bouncing back in Florida in the day. And went through a very nasty divorce as well. Rehab, Diamond Dallas Page got into his life. He did the DDP yoga thing, got back on his feet.
That's when we met him.
Oh, he was in the throes of that?
Well, he was just out of it. I mean, he was just, he couldn't have, yeah, he was probably maybe not even a year outside of the DDP thing because we met him at the Slam Dance premiere of the Resurrection of Jake the Snake Roberts.
Oh, of course. Right. That makes sense.
And that's where I first met him for the first time.
Yeah, that's in that one. That's where he does that stretching and you can hear that crunching crackle from his hip because he had a bad hip injury and you can hear, it sounds like peanuts being stepped on or something. But he, you know, he got back in a good working order in terms of, you know, all the physical ailments and, you know, was clear eyed there. I mean, certainly it seems like a Scott Hall, Evan, that's, you know, lucid and there and present.
Yes.
And sharp. He didn't really lose that. If you caught him on a good day, I guess you could say, and he talked to you guys about how he loved having the Razor Ramon gimmick in WWF in particular because when he was Razor Ramon, he didn't have to worry about all the personal struggles that he was going through, the divorce, the challenges at home, you know, his troubled past, all of that kind of stuff, scandal. And in the interview, you guys ask him to describe the Razor Ramon character, and he takes his answer to an interesting place, I think. He starts recalling how he started out in the business as basically a Magnum PI lookalike with the porn stash and the hairy chest in the AWA using his real name, Big Scott Hall, and how as much as he lampooned the idea over his life of believing in your character and taking the business that seriously or you know, hiding behind kayfabe, maybe the fact that Razor Ramon was fake provided the shroud that he needed.
And at that time, I'm working in the AWA and this and that, and I got a big Village People mustache and bushy brown hair, and I would meet people, and they go, you wrestling? I go, yeah, how you doing? Well, what's your name? I go, Scott Hall. No, what's your wrestling name? Like, I was Scott Hall in the grocery store. I was Scott Hall in the ring. So I realized I need a character. Like, I'll never forget one time I put a guy's mask on, like a wrestling mask, and I felt this freedom come over me, like, wow. I could be whoever I want. Like, nobody knows who I am. Like, for me, when I got to be Razor, I got to be the bad guy. Like, ask Scott Hall, how's life's going? Oh, my God, I'm getting divorced. Oh, my God, my kids don't talk to me. Oh, my God. How's Razor doing? Hey, Razor, how you doing? Better than you, Chico. You know, like, when I got to, no matter how my life was going in the locker room, when I got to step through that curtain, I'm the bad guy, and he's doing better than you.
Scott Hall passed away March 14th, 2022, shortly after undergoing hip replacement surgery and a blood clot issue, causing him to be essentially put under medical supervision. He suffered 3 heart attacks while on life support at a hospital in Marietta, Georgia, and was taken off that life support on March 14th, 2022. His family traveled to see him at the hospital, his friends as well. calls people bedside. Kevin Nash immediately made the trek, and he passed away a few hours later at the age of 63. Scott Hall, JP, quite a voice. Always puts you in an interesting headspace to hear him wax nostalgic. And fortunately for us, he did it for Dark Side Cameras in his time.
I think we talked about it when we did our tribute to Scott Hall, as he was such a guy like that. If he kind of hadn't been in these right places at the right time, he probably wouldn't be as notable to wrestling fans. But because he was, and he was a founding member of the NWO and all that, like, in, you know, because he was such a top guy in WWE and then went over in WCW at this crucial time, it's like all these things, like the stars really aligned to make him one of the most important wrestlers of the 1990s.
One of the things people started putting out on social when he passed away was like pictures of how he would dress and how ahead of the curve he seemed to be in terms of the fashion he would wear for photo shoots at the NWO. And the NWO t-shirts took on a different life of their own just a few years ago. It was suddenly like a throwback thing to wear for the younger set. It's a lot ties back to Scott and Evan, just the kind of blasé, kind of breezy yet edgy way he talks about himself and his career and the people he encountered in the wrestling business.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember planning out season one of the show and trying to game plan, who are we going to talk to? Who do we want to talk to? You know, and it was just like, well, we said last week, Jake, incredible on the mic, amazing storyteller. You know, his performance in his storytelling is so keen. Jim Cornette was another person that we'd watched so many interviews of and, you know, been fans of his podcast. The guy could perform and he could talk and he could tell a story. And Scott was right there, man. You know, he has his own unique style of delivery, his own unique contrarian points of view. And it just all added up to, I think, those sort of founding, you know, principles or foundations of the show that sort of made it what it was, were just getting the right voices on these shows. And the ones that we could get, obviously we were very limited by, you know, the WWE of it all and everything. But man, yeah, it is a shame that we didn't really get to work with Scott again after season one. And it wasn't anything more than, I think, just time and place. And when it came around to season three, I just remember it was in the throes of the pandemic. That was 2020 when we were doing season three. And I just remember that he wasn't doing so well. And he, you know, he's a social guy. And I think the isolation, because that time was so difficult. And for him, because he had so many heart problems, and he had previous heart attacks and had stents in his heart, that he really was advised by all doctors, like, just don't do anything, you know, don't go anywhere. And so I think the isolation that he experienced in I think Atlanta is where he was very difficult for him. And so I have a lot of empathy for that, you know, because I know he was a guy that loved to be out there and talking with fans, and he taught, you know, and he ingratiated me like he had known me for a long time, you know, and it was amazing, you know, just like, hey, you want to go get some sushi? You don't even know me, but you know, it was amazing to have that experience and that he trusted us and everything. So, yeah, I mean, Scott, definitely when I look back at some of the more foundational people that had agreed to work with us and is a huge part of making the show what it is. So, you know, huge shout out to Scott for, you know, sort of believing in what we wanted to do.
Absolutely. And you're spot on in terms of Scott having a difficult time. It definitely is in contradiction to just how much of a butterfly, social butterfly he was. And it comes through in the interview and the tone of his voice to be locked in the pandemic. And Sean Waltman talked to the Wrestling Observer about it and said, you know, the pandemic did him in. That was the quote. It was hard enough for him as it was, but he was isolated in his house with no social interaction. He fell and hurt his hip, and that's kind of what led to the chain of unfortunate medical situations for Scott Hall, the bad guy. But in his time, he was able to grab that Razor Ramon character that we all remember and get some escape from what turned out to be a deeply complex guy and a complex life. So that'll do it this week for us here on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard. Again, tune in to the latest episode of Season 5 of Dark Side. It's coming up Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV with a look at ECW's The Sandman. And for now, it's back to the vault for us, and we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring, Unheard.